Today, sleepwalking deeper into crisis. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics, one latest post covering finance and proper news with a distinctively Australian flavour and with a little philosophy on the side. Today, I'm joined by journalist Tarek Brooker. Hi, Tarek.
G'day, Martin. How are you?
I'm cold. This isn't Australian weather. I want to send it back and get some warm stuff, please.
Yeah, I feel the same way, mate. I've got my hoodie here. It's far too cold for anything else today.
It really is an Antarctic blast, isn't it? But and interestingly, of course, the economy is on freeze control at the moment, but the financial markets have been turned up to max and are very, very hot.
Aren't they ever? You know, I just keep looking at all these various forecasts, you know, from the RBA, from the IMF. Everyone's downgrading. Everyone's saying, you know, things are gloomier than we expected. You know, I mean, I was looking at the numbers yesterday from the US. You know, there's 31 million people still unemployed, despite the fact that the markets are roaring ahead. And, you know, eventually the earnings have to catch up with them, I'd think, you know.
Well, there is a long-term theory that the price of a stock has something to do with earnings. But no, I think at the moment it's completely disconnected. And it is very much a balance, I think. And also the fact that, of course, they are assuming central banks will go on printing and will always rescue us. So there's always the optimism. Effectively, the market's been underpinned. So rather than having a free market, which of course means that you can get upside but also downside, everyone's now assuming that the Fed will buttress the downside, which means there's only ever upside. I think that's the key issue.
No, you're absolutely right. You know, people say, oh, it's QE, it's the injection of capital. And to a degree, I think that's correct. But I think the biggest thing is the belief that the Fed won't allow anything bad to happen. Now, I mean, you can sort of speculate on how the sort of equity market is going to play out in the longer term. But I think that one of the really interesting things is how far high yield bond yields have come down. You know, junk bond yields have come down enormously from where they were back in March. Yep. And they still keep going down and down. And that's really, really not reflecting the risk that even, you know, analysts are seeing in the market, talking about, you know, high yield bond defaults of somewhere between 6% and 10%. And I think that there's probably further downside that potentially there as well.
Yeah, well, I was talking to somebody during the week who very much looks on the macro picture, and he said, watch bonds. Bonds is where you will see the cracks spread first, because his belief is like yours, that the bond yields are artificially low at the moment. And that's one reason, of course, why gold has gone very high, because as yields come down, then effectively the opportunity cost of not holding gold goes down as well. You might just as well hold gold because you're not going to get many returns from other investment classes, right? That's the sort of the theory. But the trouble is that those bond rates are artificially low, and the chances are that as the default rates start to work through, as they will, there's no doubt about that, we're going to see that move quite quickly. And he was saying that within 60 days, he expects the thing to turn on its head, and then that will really be the trigger that will then start puncturing the stock markets in the US and therefore around the world. So his view is we're on a knife edge. And in fact, he other made an interesting point, which is that most of the upside in terms of the markets now are being driven by relatively naive new investors who've come in with their government checks and are basically throwing money into the market thinking, this is easy. I buy at 100 and then a week later it's 110. You know, I can't lose. And of course, the fact is that that may be true for the short term, but longer term, probably not so. Many professional investors are already withdrawing money. They're actually holding it in cash at the moment, waiting for the next trajectory. So watch this space. It's definitely weird. But then, of course, you've still got the uncertainty about the economic outlook. The statement of monetary policy just came out today from the Reserve Bank basically has downgraded the GDP for next year, upgraded their expectations in terms of unemployment to 10% now by the end of this year officially. Of course, the real number's higher, and then higher next year, still 7% in 2020. So the unemployment rate, even with their best optimistic outlook, is going to be higher than it was. And of course, they talk about some of the other issues. But one interesting observation they did make was that if consumers start to think that actually this whole thing is going to grind on for a lot longer, then they are really going to be much, much more cautious. They're going to be less likely to take more loans, buy houses, those sorts of things. So, I think what I'm pointing to there is you can talk about all the economics and all the symmetries there and asymmetries, but actually it is fundamentally about confidence and consumer confidence of that.
Yeah, absolutely. It's about psychology. I mean, it's been quite fascinating, really. Like I watch, you know, used car sales. That's like, you know, that's my thing. And, you know, the number of people, you know, buying up used cars, even for what would be considered extremely excessive prices, has just skyrocketed. You know, you can make all sorts of arguments. Oh, it's on the back of JobKeeper. It's on the back of super withdrawals. It's on the back of a rising stock market. But I think there's more to it. You know, I think that people have sort of had this little bit of a brush with the pandemic, a brush with death, and they're sort of just reacting accordingly after being, you know, stuck inside, you know, not being able to do anything. They've sort of just blasted out. You know, you've seen that with Nick Scali's furniture store, you know, like absolutely bumper results. And I think that that really just goes to show where we're at in terms of confidence and in terms of how the economy is being perceived. You know, I mean, Alex Joyner had a graph the other day showing that, you know, real unemployment, once you count in 0 hours and also the reduction in the participation rate since earlier this year, you know, is something around about 16%. You know, so that paints a sort of fairly sort of dismal picture of where we could be when JobKeeper does finally conclude. But it really does sort of make you think about consumers. They're very bullish. They're out there spending, you know, near record amounts of money on retail. And obviously part of that's driven by stimulus, but people are still more confident than you'd expect. You know, I talk to people and they say, oh, people are still out there buying houses. They're paying more than pre-COVID prices in some places. And, you know, like the reality of things is just doesn't seem to matter. You know, people just think that this sort of government-induced limbo of, you know, no insolvencies, no bankruptcies, you know, nothing bad can happen because ScoMo's got your back is just going to go on forever.
Well, there's no doubt that the government has underwritten the economy. You know, $100 billion in this current quarter is, I think, if you add everything up, is about what it is. Next quarter, of course, it was a lot lower, although they've added another $15 billion in today to say we're going to have to keep JobKeeper, you know, paying longer. Although they're still not going to pay it down, they're just going to open it up for more businesses. So that's definitely one of the things that's on people's radar. And, of course, people also help themselves to some super. And a lot of people probably didn't need to, but did anyway. So, you know, up to $20,000 for there. So there's a bit of money coming in there as well. So there is a lot of liquidity. And if you look at the broad money measure, it's at more than 10%, right? So there's a lot of cash flushing around in the system. But, of course, it's not necessarily productive, and it's not necessarily going into things that help to build the economy into the future. And I guess the thing that I'm very concerned about is the disconnect between the economic realities, if you look at the metrics and numbers, and if you really look at what's going on, and the attitudes displayed by consumers, as you say, who still seem to be quite spending merrily, and indeed some of the politicians who still prefer to say, well, you know, this is a bit of a blip, but we'll get through it, no issues, rather than actually saying something along the lines of, well, this is probably the most critical issue. The decisions that we take, will lay the foundation for the next 10 or 15, 20 years, which is, I think, how I see it. But I am worried about this cliff, you know, because they've shifted out a bit, but it's still going down. And we've still got the issues in Victoria, and we've still got the borders shut now. And I was reading something today that suggested, well, this actually might be the catalyst to create a more fragmented Australia, because you might suddenly find that WA says, well, look, we're going to hold on to our tax from all our iron ore exports, and we'll just keep them for locally rather than actually putting it into the general kitty, not least because GST is going to be way down. So, you know, there are so many issues in play.
No, absolutely. I was speculating a few weeks ago that this could reignite the WA secessionist movement. You know, they're virus free. They've got, you know, the iron ore. They've got all these different things going on there. You know, they could open up to New Zealand and other countries for tourism tomorrow if they chose to. And, you know, I mean, I think we're going to see a very similar sort of trend in other states as well. You know, maybe we'll see a sort of Australia excluding New South Wales and Victoria, or Australia excluding Victoria, because, you know, I really can't see them opening up these borders unless, of course, they're forced by the current case that's going to go before the High Court. You know, where Clive Palmer's taking the WA government to court over the border closures. But realistically, if Palmer loses, there's not really any reason to open up the borders. I mean, There was a poll out the other day in WA, 96% of people support the border closure. I mean, those levels, that level in any sort of poll on anything, even if it's I don't like child molesters, is, you know, it's absolutely, you know, almost unheard of. You know, it's really quite fascinating. And not only that, but I think we're gonna see something very interesting in Queensland in October. I believe it's October off the top of my head, when they have their state election.
Yeah.
Because if Anna Pasluck and her government is strongly re-elected on the back of her strong border stance, and if Queensland continues to keep the virus under control, it's really going to signal for a lot of these other state leaders that it's politically beneficial for them to continue with this status quo to make sure that the virus is kept away from their states. And that's going to really, really complicate things for Victoria in the long run, if that is the case.
Well, it's interesting because I think what you're highlighting is this deadly embrace between economics and, you know, levers to do with the economy and the political overlay. And how many of the decisions that are being taken at the moment are predominantly driven by politics rather than economics or indeed health? You know, hard to know. But I suspect that some of the decisions taken up in Queensland is with an eye to the next election, as you say, which is not far away. And in WA, I mean, every time I go to WA, I always feel like it is another country, and actually the way they think and the way they talk, the border's been there forever. You know, it's yeah. Very interesting. And yeah, we could definitely see something of a fragmentation. And of course, the real interesting question is the relationship between the federal states and who owns what, and, you know, which money goes where. And I've noticed that ScoMo again keeps saying, well, no, that's a state issue. You know, they've got to make some decisions around that. So he's quite happy to backpedal and let them make some of the decisions for some of the elements that critically will be important into the future. I mean, I do think this is a bit of a turning point potentially in the way that Australia thinks about itself. And I just wonder whether the federal-state relationships and indeed the federation itself will actually be coming out the back of this in a very different state.
I think it's definitely going to be coming out different. I think it's just a question of how, to what degree. You know, I mean, ScoMo keeps saying, oh, it's a state issue, they need to do this, they need to do that. But what this has done is highlight the imbalance between the responsibilities of the states and the actual revenue they derive from, you know, their various revenue collection schemes, whether it's, you know, payroll tax or stamp duty or whatever, because they don't have the ability, like the federal government, to run up these enormous deficits, to spend hundreds and hundreds of billions without it having a significant impact on their bottom line and a significant impact on their borrowing costs. You know, we're already talking about rating agencies potentially downgrading Victoria, because, you know, I mean, realistically, I don't really see how they avoid being downgraded in the long term. You know, the hit to the budget bottom line is going to be enormous. But ScoMo keeps leaning on them to do all these things. You know, say, for example, even with the, what is it called? Job maker or job trainer? I forget. There's so many of them, job this and job that. And you know, he's saying, okay, we're gonna federally fund half of this, but the other half is going to have to come from the states. And I just feel like saying to Scott Morrison, with what money? With what money? You know, you guys can borrow till, you know, World War II size deficits. You know, you can go absolutely mad, you know, 15, 20% deficits potentially down the road. But the states can't do that. They'll run into trouble, and it's just going to create more and more issues within the states and more animosity towards the federal government.
No, well, I think you're absolutely right there. And if you look over in the US, because the states and feds over there have a bit the same tussle, right? And what we're seeing over there is that the states are actually having to cut back on their expenditure simply to try and keep their budgets relatively balanced. And they're actually cutting back on healthcare workers and police and other frontline services, despite the fact that in the US the virus is still raging. And it's because it's a similar dilemma. They don't really have any alternative. They've got to try and keep their budgets relatively balanced. But yeah, it really is slightly weird when you think that you know, the GST was meant to replace a lot of these state taxes, and now we've got the GST plus all these other state taxes still in place, pretty much, right? And yet the states also are quite limited in their decision-making capability. Although I noticed that WA was quite happy to follow on from, you know, the federal building incentive for, you know, go buy new land packages. They've actually thrown their own money in there too, so they can still support the construction sector. So that seems to be number one on the list.
Well, you raise a very interesting point with the construction sector, and you know it. I mean, realistically, outside of the sort of what would you consider, essential elements of essential industries of the economy, things like retail, things like healthcare, it is the next biggest industry. It is the biggest discretionary industry, and I think that we're really seeing where the government's priorities lie, not only at a federal level, but at a state level as well. People say, oh, they're going to prop up housing prices, they're going to do this, they're going to do that. And I think they probably will to a degree. But at the end of the day, it's about saving jobs. It's about saving the productive economy. Now, while I think that there are some people in the Liberal Party room and in Parliament in general who aren't taking this sufficiently seriously, who believe that we've beaten this, who believe that somehow, we're going to dodge this bullet the same way we've dodged every other bullet for the last 30 years. At the end of the day, there are others who realize the scale of this challenge. They realize that there's going to be industries and people coming out of the woodwork over the next, 2, 3, 4 years who are all going to have their cap in hand, wanting a handout, wanting federal government support. And we're already heading for a $250 billion deficit. With this additional JobKeeper payments, with the stage four lockdowns in Victoria, we're probably heading towards something more like $300 billion. And at the end of the day, people need to realize that while the Morrison government is currently suppressing a lot of its sort of ideological urges, it still has that traditional fiscal conservative streak that it wants to embrace, that it wants to embrace very badly. And I still think that we're going to see things get cut. Like the people say, oh, but they don't care about the deficit. It's like, well, okay, no, they don't care about the deficit, but they want to make it seem like they do. Like say for example, they cut the JobKeeper for the childcare sector, and we're going to see these little things, these little around the edges changes, because they're going to need to fund their ideological agenda. They're going to need to fund corporate tax cuts. They're going to need to fund all these other various things that they've been talking about. Workplace relations reform, all these various different things need to have the money come from somewhere. And it's just very, very interesting, because there's all these different competing forces, all these different ideologies. And we do ostensibly live in a democracy. And unlike say the US, where Trump can just wave his magic wand and the Republicans all jump, ScoMo still has to deal with the party room, and he still needs to get their support on things. And as I've said to a few people recently, ScoMo was always a compromise candidate. Even after his big election victories, he's still not as secure as he would be as if he had a big, powerful faction behind him, or a big agreement, like say the one that backstopped the Howard government and kept it so stable and solid for 11 years.
Well, that's absolutely right. And talking about ideology, what did you make of Frydenberg's reference to Reagan and Thatcher as, somewhere to look for ideas?
I think he's just saying what everyone in the Liberal Party room's thinking. Well, maybe not everyone, but I'd say the majority.
Right.
Like you listen to them, it's all, classic trickle-down economics.
Hmm.
And while, Scott Morrison is, has managed to basically, sort of walk that back and try and talk about an Australian solution, and he used Australian four times in a single sentence, which I thought was quite impressive. At the end of the day, that is the way they see things. Like, if you look at the agendas being proposed, if you look at, sort of like, cutting the corporate tax rates, all these sort of very, deregulating all these various different things, it's classic Reaganism and Thatcherism. It's just embracing the Liberal Party wish list that's been, the right wing of the Liberal Party's wish list that's been there the whole time, always there behind the scenes, but they've never been able to press for it. Because, I mean, if you cut the corporate tax rate significantly, under normal circumstances, even more significantly than they already have, you're going to create a massive deficit problem. And under normal circumstances, that's a big, big problem for a conservative government, because they want to be seen as superior economic managers. But at the moment, the deficit's already in the stratosphere. They can basically do whatever the hell they want, within reason. On those sort of things that cost maybe 10, 15, $20 billion, they can throw that amount of money at the economy and no one's going to care.
Well, that's true. But look, one thing I want to sort of explore, and it's sort of directly related to that, is the informal workforce, the gig economy. I would argue that one of the main things that really has been revealed by what's happened through COVID and everything else is that we've got, 3 to 4 million people who are in insecure employment, basically working one or two shifts, not getting any leave, not getting any entitlements. And this, to me, has been effectively a core component of the so-called workplace reforms in recent times. And it seems to me that that's one of their ongoing agendas, to reduce the costs of paying people and reducing some of those safety nets. And yet it seems to me this is precisely the root cause issue that's really triggered the COVID re-emergence in Victoria. And I just wonder whether that is really, you know, shining an ideological spotlight on precisely the question of what is work and what is the nature of work.
No, you're absolutely right. I think that this crisis has really exposed that and a lot of other issues that have been there for a long time in the economy that have been really quite systemic. You know, and it's been affecting the way that our economy operates for a long time. You know, if you have insecure work, you'll find it difficult to buy a home. You'll find it difficult to start a business, you know, to be able to put down roots in a community, because, you know, you don't know if you're going to be able to keep your job, if you're just going to be sent somewhere, you know, halfway across the city. And I think it just really laid bare a lot of the problems that we have. And I think that it really illustrates that we need to sort of have this big discussion about all of these various issues that we have as a nation, that we have on the macro level and the micro level. Because if we don't fix the problems we have now, if we just go back to the way things were before, it's not really going to accomplish or solve anything. You know, I mean, before COVID, we had rising unemployment, we had stagnating wages, you know, we had per capita household income going nowhere, you know, and, you know, I mean, it was going nowhere for something like 2 years. You know, this was not a healthy economy. And I think it's quite ridiculous the way that Scott Morrison and Josh Frydenberg get up on the podium and they say, we're going to return to the way things were before. And it's like, that's not something to aspire to, guys. The economy was sick. You know, we need to aspire to a better economy, something that's going to drive prosperity for people and for everyone, not just, you know, the wealthy few, rather than, you know, all the people in the gig economy and that all missing out.
Well, I absolutely agree with that. I don't know whether you saw, but Kenneth Hain, who was the commissioner from the Banking Royal Commission, made a wonderful speech in the week. And he basically said, you know, the politicians are really only able to deal with, you know, short-term incrementalist things and worrying about being re-elected. They can't take any strategic decisions. They just continually flick them off to various inquiries. And I suspect he was thinking in the back of his mind, well, you know, we did all the work on the Royal Commission within banking and financial services. We identified the critical issues that need to be addressed, and then basically nothing happened, right? And I thought that was a really interesting observation. And then if you apply that in the context of the post-COVID environment, we have to think differently. We have to take our imaginations to a new place to be able to create a new alternative environment for the future, not just going back to the Reagan-Thatcher trickle-down, as you said earlier on. And, you know, the old bootstrap trick where basically you try and, you know, help, you know, climb up your own bootstraps to try and actually improve has proven to be a massive failure, not just here, but around the world. And it seems to me that we should come back to some fundamental questions about what are the core values of Australia and being Australian. And it seems to me that part of it is there should be an approach which actually is for maximising the, you know, the well-being and the benefits of the broader Australian population, not just the politicians down in Canberra. And it shouldn't be just so ideologically aligned to business, so that effectively business gets all the plaudits and everybody else is just seen as cannon fodder to sort of feed business, which is, I think, how the model is currently articulated. But this would require a massive reimagination and a very different change of perspective. And I'm afraid I don't believe that the current incumbents are capable of it.
No, I don't realistically think they are. I mean, I think that our opinion, and I think probably the public's opinion on that, can be summed up by that famous photo of Kenneth Hain and Josh Frydenberg the day of the release of the Royal Commission. And Kenneth Hain was not a happy man. You know, he could not hide his frustration in that moment. And I think, you know, his speech this week really illustrated, you know, sort of how he feels about things after, you know, a lifetime of experiencing all of this stuff firsthand. But I think, you know, it sort of just speaks to the way that this crisis is being approached. Like I sent you a graph on on Twitter. And it basically just shows that we are spending all of this money, all these hundreds and hundreds of billions that have been slated, all this debt that we're going into is all being spent as basically a stopgap, as this thing, as this effort to keep the economy in limbo, to keep everything just ticking over in the hope that somehow, maybe, you know, at first it was later in the year, now it's next year, that somehow everything's just going to return to normal. And obviously we both know it's not. A lot of people know it's not. I mean, even the RBA's forecasts now know it's not. Maybe they're still too optimistic, but they're getting there. And that really illustrates where we're at. There's no plan for the recovery. You know, Scott Morrison said today, oh, we have a very, very strong plan for a recovery. No, you don't. That graph illustrates it all. Perhaps you should put it up on the screen for the viewers. It shows that the recovery spending as a percentage of what we're spending in total is absolutely tiny. We don't have a plan for a recovery. It's literally just, oh, let's hope things go back to normal. And I look at the RBA's forecast for unemployment to get back down to sort of a reasonable level of, I mean, even though 7.5% isn't all that reasonable, it's still quite high. But to be honest, Alex Joyner has a great graph. I believe I sent that one to you too. And it shows, you know, this recession versus all the others of how long it takes the labor market to recover. And the idea that we're going to get from sort of 10% or more unemployment back to 7.5% that quickly in this global environment, I think is extremely optimistic, you know, sort of bar some sort of collapse in the participation rate.
Well, it goes back to what we said in a few shows ago. We basically called out then the fact that this wasn't going to be V-shaped. You know, it was going to take a long tail, all right? And I remember we said at that point, and of course, if the virus continues to rage and comes back for wave two, then it just gets longer and deeper. And now, of course, we've got that and we've got more, and we're seeing just how profoundly different the economy is going to be ahead. And yet, as you say, the whole philosophy and approach is basically holding pattern. We'll just keep the economy going around in a circle until one of the airports fogs clear and we can bring it into land. I mean, that's basically what I'm seeing, right? There's nothing in terms of actually saying, well, actually, what happens if that fog continues for a long time? And what happens if we should be thinking about a different airport because there's an alternative strategy that we should be taking? I get more and more frustrated. I'm afraid I did a post last week, which was actually on the housing sector, and I got quite angry as I was making this post because it's so blooming obvious, right, what's going on, and yet the guys in power just don't seem to be able to either recognize it, or maybe they do recognize it but prefer not to talk about it because their alternative reality, the one that they live in, is all about making sure they get re-elected, making sure that the status quo is preserved, making sure that their business mates are actually supported. You can see the agenda, right? But it's missing the big picture issues that we should be talking about and we should be laying the foundations for now, because, you know, this is actually a once in a generation opportunity, if people did but see it, to address some of those really critical issues to be able to take us to a new, better place. And yet I still think that, as you say, they're looking to go back to where they were, you know, 10, 15 years ago and just replay that tape. And that didn't work so well, did it?
No. No, and I think you hit the nail on the head multiple times. So, you know, in that little discussion there. I mean, you know, for one, you know, say for example, you make the analogy of the plane flying around and around in circles. You're absolutely right. It's going to keep flying around and around and around until it crashes, and that's probably exactly what's going to happen. You know, I also your video on property, I found it quite inspiring. You know, you really hit the nail on the head. And to be honest, I think that's just emblematic of what's happening at the moment. Like, it's not just the government, it's the consumer, it's the forecasts from all these various different investment houses and hedge funds and all these different people. I mean, obviously some people are on the ball, but they seem to be in the minority. You know, like, people ask me, oh, how did you get it all right? How did you know that all this, there wasn't going to be a V-shaped recovery? It's like, because it was bloody obvious.
I know.
You know? Yeah. It's been obvious since day one. It was never, ever going to happen. And even the stuff they're talking about now of unemployment coming down quickly, it's not going to happen. No. I'm sorry. You know, like, I look at America, and my apologies to the viewers if I get a little bit frustrated here, but I look at America, there is 31 million people unemployed. There is still over 1 million people losing their job every week. You know, Europe is potentially heading for a second wave of the virus. You know, virus cases are upticking in Spain and France and in other places. And, you know, people say to me, oh, you know, but China's coming back strongly. And I just feel like saying, okay, well, let's say they've kickstarted the factories. Let's say all the data is true, which it's not. But let's say for argument's sake that it is. That is driven by the fact that we've seen massive fiscal stimulus, we've seen massive handouts on an absolutely enormous scale, that's like Marshall Plan sized handouts, all crammed into a few months. And of course, there's going to be demand for iPhones. Of course, there's going to be demand for components for new cars that people are going out and buying in America like crazy people on finance. You know, it's obvious. But once this stimulus starts to get pulled, as we've seen in America, you know, we've seen the unemployment pulled, we've seen the eviction ban pulled, you know, they're all still arguing about it. And as of this morning, Mitch McConnell and the senators have all taken a nice 3-day weekend while the rest of America burns, you know, and people say, oh, but China's going to come back strong. It's like their consumer base is being destroyed. They can't, if they can't sell stuff, look at how badly they got hit by the trade war. This is the trade war times 50. You know, it boggles my mind that people think that there's going to be these strong recoveries when there's not. Are strong recoveries possible? Absolutely. Very much so. But there needs to be a plan. There needs to be, you know, massive stimulus. There needs to be all these various things to create a long-term, prosperous, sustainable plan. But that's not what we're seeing, you know. In Europe, they're arguing and arguing and arguing until they finally come to a plan that's relatively piecemeal compared with the scale of the challenge. In America, they argue and argue, and then they don't end up doing anything at all. And here in Australia, we just keep throwing more and more money at the economy, you know, more and more little bits of fuel at the plane, hoping that it's going to keep going until finally we run out of money for the fuel and the bloody thing crashes.
That analogy is working quite well, isn't it? We must make a note of that, use the plane analogy. But no, you're right. And the point of course is that time passes, right? And as time passes, the financial position of individual households continue to get eroded. And the number of businesses that effectively fall over and don't come back goes up. And the broader economic impact on society, you know, gets very, very much more significant. But I also want to highlight the other issue. And I spoke to Eddie Hobbs some time ago. Eddie Hobbs is in Ireland, and he was there through the global financial crisis in Ireland when, of course, the same scenarios that we're seeing here were playing out there. And he kept coming back to, don't forget, this is more than an economic or a financial crisis. This is a social issue as well. And, you know, There are significant impacts on families and on households and on health and all those things too. And he said, ultimately, you'll realize that it's the social impact and the social consequences of what's going on that will be the thing that will hang over probably a lot longer. And, you know, there were many, many people who ended up in very, very bad situations, socially speaking, right? And it was a consequences of bad policy. It was a consequences of, you know, the financial system blowing up and all those things. And I just think we're not really taking enough account of the broader social issues that really they're under the surface. And I worry that that's something else that should be on the agenda when it comes to fixing, you know, Australia going forward.
No, you're absolutely right. I mean, the federal government the other day announced that they would be doubling the number of free mental health sessions to Victorians affected by the lockdown. And, you know, credit where credit is due. Absolutely. I think that's an absolutely fantastic thing. Yep. But by the same token, I also think that it's a band-aid for a bullet wound.
Yep.
You know, sort of no joke. It is a band-aid for a bullet wound. You know, so many people are suffering. You know, I mean, I saw what we're seeing nationally on a lower level, at a local level, you know, throughout my childhood and throughout my formative years. And it's not a nice time. And there wasn't the support there that people needed. And a lot of people fell through the cracks. And I look at the way things are playing out now, you know, like I was talking to my barber the other day and she was telling me that the police officers come in and get their haircuts. And they were saying that the number of domestic violence incidents, the number of, you know, child abuse incidents had absolutely skyrocketed as people struggle. And it's absolutely bloody awful. You know, people out there are really, really struggling. They're getting smashed by this economically, emotionally, mentally. It's really, really hitting people hard. And the actions that we've seen from the various governments so far has been piecemeal compared to the scale of the struggle that people are enduring. And things are, and I don't want to put too fine a point on it or go full on bearish, but the reality of this crisis is still in front of us. You know, for the moment, we've had all this money flowing in. We've had JobKeeper, we've had the JobSeeker supplement, we've had business cash injections, we've had handouts to people, you know, $750 handouts to people on Centrelink, you know, but that's transitory. The real crisis, the real meat and potatoes of this crisis is still ahead of us. And I think, you know, I think back to talking to my barber about it and the police officers, and I just think if that's how bad it is now, how bad is it going to be in 6 months, 12 months, 18 months time when unemployment is still over 8%? And that's the RBA's forecast, and we know how good they are at forecasting downside scenarios.
As good as the Treasury. I shouldn't say that. Yeah, well, you know, the fact is, if you look at, I come back to this, Mandurah in Western Australia, right? There's one of those outer suburban postcodes on the coast, right? They've had all of these issues playing out ahead of time. So you can actually regard them as a bit of a time machine, because you can see the social consequences, the impacts on falling house prices, the impact on wealth degradation, all of those things. And I noticed in my latest data, Mandurah has some of the highest stressed property investors in the country even now, right? But it's the social impact over there, you know, that's really significant. And I also want to make the other point is that, and I've been speaking to a few people about around the world on this, that quite often when you get these social issues and all those dreadful issues that we've been talking about coming to the fore, people then start talking about mental health, and they sort of start getting people to internalize and take responsibility for their mental health, and they give them a pill and say, there we are, we solved it, right? The fact is that a lot of these issues, and mental health issues quite often too, are created by the environmental, economic and social fabric that actually doesn't work properly. And therefore, trying to solve it by simply giving out pills and saying it's a mental health problem is missing the root cause drivers that created the issues in the first place. And again, it comes right back to, you've got to get into fundamentals here. You can't just deal with peripheral issues around the edge, you know, and, you know, a little bit more funding for mental health, fine. But you've got to ask the deeper questions, what's causing it, and how can we stop it actually driving all of these things in the wrong direction? And it's those strategic conversations and it's those critical discussions that are missing. And I get so frustrated when I see that.
Oh, me too. Absolutely. I mean, I've been going on about this for a couple of years in print. You know, I get really, really angry, truthfully.
Yeah.
You know, I've seen this play out with friends and family. You know, I've had friends die, and it's horrible, and it's really, really frustrating, because, you know, I remember watching the last election coverage and seeing that, you know, and increasingly seeing that Scott Morrison was going to win it, you know. And I remember thinking to myself, we care about franking credits, we care about negative gearing, but when someone gets up and says we have 116,000 homeless people in this country, you know, there's nothing, nothing. Yeah. And it's really, really quite frustrating, because I don't really know why it's allowed to happen, because to be completely frank with you, it doesn't really make sense from an economic perspective. You've got these people who are consistently a drain on society, who are consistently welfare dependent, who need, you know, ongoing mental health treatment, which is basically just a stopgap in the system, you know, and it just creates a long-term cycle of government expenditure, when you're much better off if you help them become a well-adjusted member of society. To you know, obviously there are people who are beyond help, you know, who can't be integrated, and that's just the way it is. But a lot of people can, particularly those people who have mental health issues as a result of substance abuse. You know, I mean, there was an article in the ABC a few years ago. I imagine that the figures are relatively similar now, but there's a 300,000 place deficit in the number of beds required for drug and alcohol rehab in Australia. 300,000. It was already, you know, an epidemic you know, of people who needed help, who couldn't get it before this crisis. And then I look at these figures coming from the Australian Bureau of Statistics showing that alcohol consumption is up 50%. You know, God knows how much illicit drug consumption is up. And I just think, how are we going to address these problems? You know, people needed help before. The system was overstretched before. What is it going to be like in 12, 18 months' time?
Yeah. And I want to make the point there, Tarek, that these are politically driven decisions that people take. In other words, where do we spend the money, where do we don't spend the money, right? It's not that these problems are insolvable. If you actually did intentionally go after to solve it, you could, right? So therefore, there are trade-offs going on, and they prefer to do X rather than Y. They prefer to support this rather than that. That's a series of political and financial decisions that people are taking. And the second point is, a lot of the people that we're talking about here being relatively disenfranchised are not really going to be particularly impacted in terms of the votes that they make or don't make, right? So it's a sector of society that really a lot of people just say, well, you know, it's tough and it's hard and I'm sorry about that, but I'm going to go and help my big business friends again, right? Because they're the ones with the money. They're the ones that are actually going to vote for me and vote me back in. And it comes back to me to the fundamental question about what is politics about, right? If politics is about the preservation of me being in power and making sure that I get elected back next time, et cetera, which seems to me the way it works, that's one thing. But that isn't, to my mind, what this should be about. It should be about crafting a better society and building an economy that actually supports the greater community and, you know, creates wealth, obviously, and you know, getting some of that wealth out there as well. But that's a strategic conversation that we don't want to have. And I'm very, very, very frustrated, therefore, about this tactical short-termism that we've got at the moment, right? And again, it comes right back to where we came in. We're sleepwalking into a future that is more like the past rather than actually waking up, smelling the roses and saying, there is another way, right? And then taking off and running with it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think the problem is honestly, if we could sleepwalk into a future that was like the past, I'd be quite pleased with that, relatively speaking.
But I'm not sure. You're not sure you can. That's the problem.
No, exactly. That is the problem. I mean, yeah. it's not just a crisis of economies, as you correctly pointed out. It's a crisis of society. It's a crisis of people's, you know, personal and collective psychology.
Yeah.
You know, there's all these sort of various problems that we're going to have in the years ahead that just aren't being thought of. And I think that you really hit the nail on the head when you talk about the short-termism with the, oh, this person isn't going to vote for us, what difference does it make? Because, you know, there are so many issues, especially now with like the lowest borrowing costs in the history of the human race. You know, like, say, for example, we could build social housing. The government could build social housing. You know, you can get, you know, 10, 15, 20, 30-year bonds now. Some of which, you know, 30-year bonds at less than 2% interest. You know, think about, I mean, even at 2% yields, you could build social housing like crazy across this country and it would make the government money.
Yep.
It would be a net benefit to the budget, and the government would have all of these other houses on the books, which would then add to their assets, which would then, you know, sort of benefit everybody, but they don't do it.
Yep. And that would give construction sector plenty of jobs.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. You know, we could build a house for every single person on the list who needs social housing. Every single one, where there doesn't need to be a single homeless person in Australia, and it would benefit the federal budget. And not only that, but down the road, we could turn around and we could go, okay, you know, you've got your life together. You know, you've been in social housing. We've spent the money on getting you the mental health help you need, or whatever the help is you need. And now, if you want to buy the house, you can buy the house, and then we'll take that money and then we'll build more houses, or we'll do something else that benefits the community. Put together a fund that is, you know, like the Future Fund, but is deliberately dedicated to the betterment of Australia, where none of the proceeds go into general tax revenue, and all of it just goes back into helping Australians get better lives. And I think that to be completely honest with you, I think that that is at the core of the Australian identity, of the way we perceive ourselves. You know, we perceive ourselves as helping each other, as riding into battle, getting alongside Simpson and his donkey to help our mates out, to get them back, even if it's just so they die among friends. It's about this mateship. You know, John Howard used to talk about it. I didn't see much of it, unfortunately. But that's what it's about. That is how we can define ourselves if we choose to, because rates are so low that we can do that. We can build a better future for everyone. But there's no appetite to do it.
Yeah. Well, like I said, it's the decisions we take or the decisions we don't take, which tells us a lot about who we are. And I think that the spirit of Australia, which you just articulated really clearly, is really, really out there to be harnessed if people did but see it. And yet, I'm afraid that those who are making some of those decisions down the road in Canberra are just myopically aligned in a completely different direction, unfortunately. But, we all keep talking about this, Tarek. I think these issues are so critical. And, we've both got hot under the collar today because we both feel strongly about the potential that's there, right? The point is, there is things that could be done differently. There are opportunities to make Australia, a much better place for the community. And I do think that's the point. This is about understanding that we are part of a community, and Australia, is a wonderful place to be. And what we want to do is to make it wonderful for everybody rather than just the select few. And there are decisions that could be taken now to lay the foundations for the next 10 or 20 or 30 years, which would actually just take us into a completely different and much better future. And that would be improvement in lives. It would actually reduce the amount of mental health, all those things. It is all completely conceivable. It is possible. And, to turn this into a positive rant rather than a negative rant, the future is genuinely open, right? We can take those decisions and go in a different direction if we choose to. And so it does come down ultimately to political choice. And I guess what I'm suggesting is that we should be rattling the cages of those in Canberra, because they'll be locked down in Canberra now, I guess, because of the COVID, right? And say to them, there's a better way. There is a better way.
No, absolutely. I completely agree with you. I mean, I think that's the key though, isn't it? People look at people like you and me, and especially yourself, you called things like housing price terrorist and all this other crap. And I just look at it and I just go, no, we are positive about what is possible. Yep. We're negative about what we're seeing. There's two very, very different things. I'm not going to profess to know you supremely well, but I think that, you're a pretty optimistic sort of person. You have a faith in humanity and a faith of what we can achieve. And I think that's really the key point in all of this. We could make this crisis a transformative period for Australia, not just like the New Deal, but better. We could house the homeless. We could heal the mentally ill to the degree that you can. We could concentrate on all these great policies that not only improve the country and make the country more prosperous for everyone, but they improve the way that we are as people. For us to all be able to look around and go, look at what we did. Look, we solved homelessness. Look at all these other countries. Look at, we're Australians. We like chest thumping. We like saying, look at how fantastic our healthcare system is. Imagine if our country, if our society was as good as our healthcare system is relative to other places in the world. If in relative terms, we improved our society that much, and that is achievable. And I'm optimistic that it's possible, but we need the political will to actually do something about it. Rather than just going, oh shit, the deficit's blown up again.
You're talking about the vision thing, right? Which is what I come back to again and again and again. The vision thing basically says you start with a vision of where you want to get to. In fact, I interviewed someone the other day who is one of the biggest writers in the world on, motivation. And I sort of tackled him a bit on saying, well, come on, are you kidding us? Can you really think yourself into a better future? And he said, look, it's a hard job. But the point is, unless you start with a vision, unless you start with a view of where you want to get to, right, then essentially nothing happens. So this is, I think, the critical point to say that, this isn't about tactical fixing the problems, sticking plaster or lacking plaster and, just hoping it all works out, but actually create a vision and then build from there. And I actually think it's the vision thing that's missing. But the vision thing is also what we've articulated quite clearly today is achievable if we did but see it. So let's hope we get a few more people to come on board and join the vision for a better Australia.
Yeah, well, hopefully we do, mate. You know, to keep going with your plane analogy, we can just build a whole new bloody airport before it runs out of fuel.
Easy. We'll start tomorrow. Tarek, thanks for that interesting conversation. As always, I always appreciate your time and your insights. And we'll do it again soon.
Yeah, definitely. I'm looking forward to it.
Cheers.